I'm happy to introduce the speaker this evening. Before doing so, there are, as usual, a few things to say. The first is a number of you will know that, rather sadly, a past president of the Institute, Dr. Bill Weber, who was dean of medicine and an academic vice president, died 4 days ago. We certainly miss him. He was his face was often here at the Vancouver Institute, and the rest of him as well, of course. After the lecture, there will be coffee, tea, and cookies. These are free for you to take part in, and as you, some of you will have heard me say before, if you feel just the least bit guilty about having tea and cookies at somebody else's expense, we would be delighted if you were to join the Vancouver Institute. It would be cheap, but at least twice the price. Last week I mentioned that it, for a single membership, was about the cost of two boxes of cornflakes, but I neglected to mention that it's also tax deductible, so it's really even better than that. So if you feel like joining, you saw the desk as you came in, please do, or take away a pamphlet and you can mail in a check afterwards. It's very much appreciated. We do work on a slim budget, and any chance we can get to increase that a little bit helps the services that we can bring to you. There will also be a book signing. Michael has kindly consented to sign some of his books. If you would like to buy them after the lecture is over, he will be available to sign them. Next week, February the 4th, one of the benefits, of course, of membership is that you automatically get these pamphlets mailed to you. So, I heard a complaint about late, Peter. I don't think that's a... It came a good time this time, I think. Next Saturday, Professor Francoise Sullivan, a painter, sculptor, and photographer from Montreal, and Dr. Sylvia Lécuyer, a senior producer with CBC Vancouver, will be here on the podium, or the whatever we call this, for a conversation with Francoise Sullivan. I won't go into the details of her background, but many of you will know that she won a Governor General's Award in Visual Arts and Media Arts. And that should be a fascinating and rather different form of lecture next Saturday. Michael Byers informed me this evening that he thought it was a little bit ironic that last week's speaker, Jim Delgado, had been through the Northwest Passage. And he hasn't yet been through the Northwest Passage, but he's here to speak about it. But, of course, Jim spoke about something else. I was reminded of the fact that I mentioned in introducing Jim last week that this was his fourth time back at the Institute, which meant that he was a really good speaker, and the audience, I'm sure, weren't disappointed. I expect that our speaker tonight, I hope, will be back many times. He certainly comes very strongly recommended, and although I haven't yet heard him speak, I'm very much looking forward to it. He is the academic director of the Liu Institute of Global Issues here at UBC. Prior to that, he was at Duke University and was director of the Center for Canadian Studies there. And prior to that, he was at Oxford, Jesus College, Oxford, as a don. He got his doctorate from Cambridge University, and he hails from Saskatchewan. Got a degree from the University of Saskatchewan in political studies, and studied law, both droit civil and Canadian English common law, at McGill before proceeding to Cambridge. He's been a visiting professor in many different places. I've mentioned several already, but he's also been a visiting professor of law at University of Cape Town and at the University of Tel Aviv and in Hamburg. And that's not, I'm not going to go through all of the places, but he's certainly seen quite a bit of the world in a very interesting way. His books include War Law, Understanding International Law and Armed Conflict. He's co-editor of a book called United States Hegemony and the Foundations of International Law. He was editor of The Role of Law in International Politics. And I believe this related to his thesis, his first book, Custom, Power, and the Power of Rules, International Relations and Customary International Law. He has a long list of papers and talks that he's given. He, as some of you will know, he's very often interviewed by a variety of the media, including the Globe and Mail and CBC and almost any international broadcaster that you could name in the UK, Germany, Australia, France, and the Voice of America, CNN, and PBS in the States. His professional activities include giving advice to Amnesty International and a number of other related, similar kinds of organizations. That's perhaps not a good way of putting it, but he's one that interested me, and I didn't ask him about earlier, but for the Association of Relatives of Disappeared Persons, he was involved with a case that went before the British House of Lords related to Pinochet. I think you can see that there's lots of material here for him to come back and give a lot of talks. Tonight, however, our speaker is going to be talking on thinning ice, challenges to Canadian sovereignty in the Northwest Passage. Please welcome Professor Michael Byers.
Thank you for the kind introduction. Having been away from Canada for 12 years, I've come back to notice something quite curious about Canadians. Canadians suffer from a most peculiar handicap. We can see east, and we can see west, and of course we can see south. Yet, for some strange reason, most of us, particularly tonight, do not see north. Indeed, for most Canadians, this country might as well be Chile, turned sideways. 75% of us live within 160 kilometers of the U.S. border. A staggering 99.7 of us live south of 60 degrees latitude. That's the line dividing the western provinces from the territories. And this leaves just 104,000 people occupying 40% of the second largest country on earth. For most of us, in terms of our lives, our travels, our personal geographic reference, our vast Arctic spaces simply do not exist. They constitute a collective national blind spot. Yet, as any driver knows, blind spots present danger. And this is certainly true of our Arctic blind spot. And nowhere more so than in the Northwest Passage. To the north of the Canadian mainland lies a vast polar archipelago made up of 19,000 islands and countless rocks and reefs. Baffin Island is larger than the British Isles, while two of the other islands, Ellesmere and Victoria, are nearly as large. For most of the year, the straits and channels between the islands are covered by sea ice, fusing the archipelago into a triangular mass that is 3,000 kilometers wide at its base and stretches to within 900 kilometers of the geographic North Pole. Pierre Burton called the Northwest Passage the Arctic Grail. From Martin Frobisher in 1576 to John Franklin in 1845, generations of explorers battled the elements searching for a navigable route through the Arctic islands to Asia. Many of them, including Franklin and his men, perished in the effort. Their greatest challenge was sea ice. Even in summer, thick, hard, multi-year ice has long choked the straits and channels, especially in the western Arctic, rendering them impenetrable to all but the most patient of explorers, or more recently, the most powerful of icebreakers. The Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen completed the first transit in 1906, but it took him 3 years. There are several possible routes. The most common route goes to the south of the archipelago, basically through here, south of Iqaluit, up, works its way through these islands, comes out near Tuktoyaktuk. I'm not interested in that route this evening. It's too shallow and it's too narrow for commercial shipping. A supertanker, a container ship, just can't go through. What I'm interested in are the two routes that are suitable for deep-keeled vessels. Now, if one starts in the east, both deep-water routes begin in Lancaster Sound, between Baffin Island and Ellesmere Island. They continue on westward through the Barrow Strait into Viscount Melville Sound, and one of them goes from there northwest through the McClure Strait into the Arctic Ocean. The other turns to the southwest here and goes through Prince of Wales Strait into the Amundsen Gulf and then out into the Beaufort Sea. So they have in common this stretch here, and then they diverge, McClure Strait, Prince of Wales Strait. The ice conditions tend to be most difficult in here, Viscount Melville Sound, Parry Channel, McClure Strait. And the reason for that is that multi-year ice from the Arctic Ocean is pushed into the McClure Strait by the Arctic Oscillation, which is an atmospheric movement that pushes winds and currents in a circular direction like this, pushing thick, hard ice down into the archipelago. And this multi-year ice creates risks and uncertainties which have rendered the passage off-limits to shipping companies and off-limits as well to marine insurance companies. Now, however, the ice is melting. In the last 3 decades, climate change has caused a 25% decline in the area covered by Arctic sea ice. That's a decline of about 2 million square kilometers. The ice is also, on average, 32% thinner than it was before. The melt is particularly advanced in the Western Arctic, where the edge of the multi-year ice has retreated north. The multi-year ice pack in the Arctic Ocean, the edge of it has retreated north so that the leading edge is right around here, near the top end of the McClure Strait. That's important, because once this edge retreats above the entrance to the McClure Strait, we can expect a dramatic reduction in the amount of multi-year ice moving into the McClure Strait and Viscount Melville Sound. This development may explain why, in 2001, a report prepared for the U.S. Navy predicted that, quote, within 5 to 10 years, the Northwest Passage will be open to non-ice-strengthened vessels for at least 1 month each summer. 5 years from 2001 is this summer. I'm working with a colleague named David Barber, who's a Canada research chair specializing in sea ice at the University of Manitoba. And he is convinced that the McClure Strait will be open within that time frame, 2006 to 2011, to large supertankers and container ships. The changing ice conditions offer a sea route between Europe and Asia, or between the west coast of North America and Europe, or the east coast of North America and Asia, that is 7,000 kilometers shorter than the route through the Panama Canal. The Northwest Passage could also accommodate supertankers and container ships that are too large for the Panama Canal and currently have to go around the southern tip of South America. International shipping companies are eyeing the fuel, the time, the canal passage fees that could be saved. Some of them are already building ice-strengthened vessels. The cruise ship industry is also looking north. The Kapitan Chelepnikovy, a Russian-flagged converted icebreaker, already offers luxury voyages through the Northwest Passage each summer. It'll cost you $10,000 per person. The melting ice will facilitate access to Alaskan and northern Canada's vast stocks of oil, gas, diamonds, and precious metals. In addition, Canada's Arctic waters could eventually become a valuable fishery, as reduced ice cover and warmer waters enable plankton and fish species from more temperate latitudes to move north. Indeed, Pacific salmon and Atlantic cod are already invading Arctic waters, with likely dire consequences for smaller, slower-growing indigenous species. Canadians should be alarmed. An international shipping route along Canada's third coast could facilitate the entry of drugs, guns, illegal immigrants, and perhaps even terrorists into this country, as well as providing an alternative route for illicit shipments of weapons of mass destruction or missile components by rogue states. And of course, any shipping involves the risk of accidents, particularly in remote and icy waters. An oil spill would cause catastrophic damage to fragile Arctic ecosystems. A cruise ship in distress would require an expensive and possibly dangerous rescue mission. Any new fishery will be highly susceptible to overexploitation, particularly because of the difficult-to-police location, rapid decline in fish stocks elsewhere, and the consequent excess fishing capacity that now exists worldwide. Ideally, these challenges would be addressed by applying the full range of Canada's own environmental, immigration, customs, and criminal laws. Sovereignty over the Northwest Passage is about much more than nationalism. It's about protecting people and the environment from serious potential harm. Yet Canadians could soon lose any ability to regulate foreign vessels in the passage, since any foreign ship that passes through without our permission undermines our sovereignty claim. Ownership of the islands is not at issue. In 1880, Britain assigned them to Canada, and that title has not subsequently been contested, with one small exception. And it is small. In 1973, Canada and Denmark concluded a treaty delimiting the continental shelf between Ellesmere Island and Greenland. So, here. Strangely enough, Greenland is not on this map, but then again, it's not part of Canada. But they left a 1.3 square kilometer lump of rock and its surrounding shelf out of the agreement. The lump, named Hans Island, is roughly here. It's too close to the adjoining land masses to Greenland and Ellesmere Island to have much effect on the overall delimitation of the maritime boundary. And in any event, Canada and Denmark have recently agreed that the dispute is limited to the island itself. Hans Island is also, obviously, far removed from the Northwest Passage and has no consequences for it. Yet the irrelevance of the matter has not stopped the two governments from banging nationalist drums, particularly in the lead-up to a federal election. The Danish Navy visited the island on at least four occasions before the Canadian government dispatched soldiers and then the defense minister himself by helicopter in July 2005. Both sides having made their point, the two NATO allies then agreed to negotiate a solution, which will likely come in the form of a joint management regime under which the sovereignty issue over Hans Island will cease to matter. In contrast, the history of Canada's claim over the Northwest Passage is fraught with confusion and indecision. Initially, it did not seem that title over the waterway mattered much because of the nearly impenetrable ice. Still, a claim to the water was at least implicit in an assertion first made in the late 19th century that Canada owned everything between the 60th and 141st meridians of longitude all the way to the North Pole, essentially a sector, a pie, going like this, and then more or less like that, all the way to the geographic North Pole. The most famous articulation of the sector theory was made by Senator Pascal Poirier in 1907. And 2 years later, Captain J.E. Bernier of the vessel C.S. Arctic placed a plaque on Melville Island that still reads, "This memorial is erected today to commemorate the taking of possession for the Dominion of Canada of the whole Arctic archipelago lying to the north of America from longitude 60 degrees west to 141 degrees west up to latitude 90 degrees north." However, apart from the Soviet Union, which attempted a similar claim, other countries did not accept the sector theory. In 1969, an American oil company sent an ice-strengthened oil tanker, the SS Manhattan, on a test voyage through the Northwest Passage. The company, which was cooperating closely with the U.S. government, made a point of not seeking permission from Canada. Ottawa insisted on granting permission nonetheless, and even sent an icebreaker to assist. And Canada subsequently argued that this granting of unsolicited permission prevented the voyage from undermining Canada's claim. A more convincing defense of sovereignty came from an unexpected source. As the SS Manhattan plowed through the ice near Resolute Bay, going this direction, and Resolute is roughly there, two Inuit hunters drove their dog sleds into its path. The vessel ground to a halt in the ice until the hunters, having made their point, moved aside. Two Canadians gave permission. And the government of Canada doesn't seem to know anything about that. The following year, Parliament adopted the Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act, imposing safety and environmental requirements on all shipping within 100 nautical miles of the Arctic coastline, coastline of all the islands. The claimed right to pollution prevention jurisdiction was at that time contrary to international law, which did not recognize coastal state rights beyond the territorial sea. However, it was subsequently made legal by the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which allows coastal states to pass laws against maritime pollution out to 200 nautical miles when almost year-round ice creates exceptional navigational hazards. Those provisions of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea exist because of the brilliance of a few Canadian diplomats. Also in 1970, a second piece of legislation extended Canada's territorial sea from 3 to 12 nautical miles. This move was less controversial, since 60 other countries had already made similar claims. Its immediate relevance lay in the fact that the Northwest Passage, at its narrowest points, right in here, is less than 24 nautical miles across. 12 plus 12, giving you the overlapping territorial seas. And according to the Canadian government at the time, the overlapping territorial seas meant that foreign vessels making the passage would come into Canadian territorial waters and thus be subject to the full range of Canadian domestic law. At the same time, Canada began arguing that the straits and channels between the islands were, quote, historic internal waters. The latter argument rested on the fact that most of the archipelago had been mapped by British explorers prior to the transfer of title to Canada, and very few non-consensual transits had occurred. Canada also pointed out that the Inuit, who are Canadian citizens, had traveled and lived on the ice for millennia. Not just travel, but lived on the ice. There was, however, some contradiction in using both the territorial sea and historic internal waters arguments at the same time, since internal waters are, by definition, not territorial sea. It's a lawyer's point, but the confusion gave strength to the U.S. position, which holds that the Northwest Passage is an international strait. International straits are narrower in breadth than the territorial sea, but because they join two expanses of high seas, in this case, the Atlantic and Arctic Oceans, and because international straits are used for international navigation, they are open with relatively few restrictions to ships from any country. So again, international strait, two criteria, join two expanses of the high seas and are used for international navigation. Now, more than commercial shipping was at issue. During the Cold War, the United States was concerned to maintain open access for its navy, and especially its submarines, and not just through the Northwest Passage, but through straits worldwide. Under the law of the sea, submarines may pass through an international strait without surfacing or otherwise alerting the adjacent coastal state or states. Submarines are not allowed to travel underwater in another country's territorial sea or internal waters. This was a major geopolitical strategic interest of the United States during the Cold War, to be able to move its submarines through the Canadian Arctic Archipelago without telling anyone. In 1985, the U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker Polar Sea sailed through the Northwest Passage, starting at Thule, Greenland, which is somewhere around here, and working its way this way into the Beaufort Sea. It did so, again, without seeking permission. Ottawa once again made a point of granting permission. It even asked to place several observers on board. Now, Washington acceded to the request, allowing the observers, and arguably this strengthened Canada's argument that the transit was consensual. And indeed, at this point, the United States even promised to provide advance notice of any further transits by its Coast Guard vessels. Yet Washington still made a point of publicly disputing the Canadian sovereignty claim. Following the voyage of the Polar Sea, Canada again modified its legal position. Central to the new position was the drawing of straight baselines linking the outer headlands of the archipelago. So the Canadian claim now, in terms of Canadian versus international territory, would be represented by having lines between here and here and here and here and then across this here, basically closing off the entrances to the archipelago. and not extending as far out as the historic sector claim. As the result of a 1951 decision by the International Court of Justice in a dispute between Britain and Norway, straight baselines had become a legally accepted means for determining the extent of coastal state control along fragmented coastlines, or what are called coastal archipelagos. Canada invoked its prior argument of historic internal waters in support of its new baselines, arguing that its title to the waters within the baselines, which by definition are internal waters, was consolidated by historic usage. The historic usage argument was reinforced in 1993 by the Nunavut Land Claims Agreement, whereby the Canadian government and the Inuit affirmed that, quote, Canada's sovereignty over the waters of the Arctic archipelago is supported by Inuit use and occupancy, end quote. And if you speak with Inuit leaders, as I have, they will tell you that they are very proud to be Canadian and they want their historic claim to vest in Canada. The historic consolidation argument is also supported by judgments of international courts. In 1975, in a dispute between Spain and Morocco over the Western Sahara, the International Court of Justice held that the historic presence of nomadic peoples can help to establish sovereignty. And in 1933, in a dispute between Norway and Denmark over eastern Greenland, the predecessor to the International Court of Justice, the Permanent Court of International Justice, held that the degree of presence necessary to establish title over territory is lower in inhospitable regions than in more temperate climes. However, the crux of the dispute centers on the requirement that international straits are used for international navigation. Canada argues that a couple of non-consensual transits through the Northwest Passage could not provide a sufficient basis on which to consider those waters an international strait. The United States, in contrast, focuses on the geographic criterion, joining two expanses of high seas, and points to a 1949 judgment of the International Court of Justice in a dispute over the Corfu Channel, which held that the volume of traffic was of no relevance. In any event, the fact that any further usage for international navigation might contribute to the Northwest Passage becoming an international strait makes it critically important that no further non-consensual transits occur. Canada is poorly equipped to prevent such transits. Despite having the world's longest coastline, much of it ice-covered most of the time, we do not have any all-season polar icebreakers. Four of our Coast Guard icebreakers do spend each summer in the Arctic, helping supply ships and barges reach remote communities, and cargo ships and bulk carriers reach the port of Churchill in Hudson Bay. But these vessels are neither powerful enough nor ice-strengthened enough to deal with the Arctic winter. And they are redeployed to the Gulf of St. Lawrence each autumn. In 1985, Brian Mulroney's Progressive Conservative government announced that it would build a powerful all-season icebreaker, the Polar 8, only to cancel the contract 4 years later, was supposed to be built in Vancouver. It was supposed to create 800 jobs. The situation is all the more worrisome because even non-Arctic countries, such as China, Britain, South Africa, and now South Korea, own or are building vessels of this kind. South Africa has a polar-class icebreaker, and Canada does not. Canada, the South Africans use it to resupply Antarctic research bases. Canada does have a fleet of Aurora patrol aircraft, which are now used mostly for fisheries protection on the east and west coasts. Only one or two flights per year are devoted to sovereignty assertion. The Canadian Airborne Regiment was able to deploy 500 paratroopers rapidly anywhere in the Arctic until the Chrétien government disbanded it in 1995 after a couple of paratroopers tortured and killed a Somali teenager. Today, our Arctic presence is made up largely of the Canadian Rangers, 1,600 part-time volunteers who live in 58 hamlets stretching from Baffin Island to the Alaskan frontier. The Rangers know the land and the ice, and they provide a useful, if slow-moving, search and rescue capacity. Yet their abilities are dwarfed by the expanse in which they operate. Again, 40% of the second largest country on Earth. The Rangers are also not equipped or trained for forcibly boarding ocean-going vessels. Consequently, the Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act cannot, in practice, be applied. Although, to be fair, most of the vessels that enter the Canadian Arctic do meet its standards. It's also unclear whether the right held by coastal states to exercise pollution prevention jurisdiction in ice-covered waters extends to international straits. And it's unclear whether that right will continue after the ice disappears. In any event, as the ice melts, more foreign vessels could attempt to use the Northwest Passage without seeking permission, as they might do in order to evade Canada's environmental laws. And my biggest concern is some small oil company or some tramp steamer trying to save a pile of money by taking a shortcut through the Northwest Passage without insurance, with a single-hulled vessel, just trying to slip through because they know there's a very significant chance that no one will notice. And if anyone noticed, that no one would be able to stop them. Canada's legal argument could soon collapse under the weight of just a couple precedents, leaving us with little basis on which to regulate foreign vessels, even if we acquired enforcement capabilities in the future. In short, time is running out. We either get serious about sovereignty and protecting the environment in the Northwest Passage now, or we will lose the right to do so. Submarine transits, which are not dependent on channels free of ice, pose a particular problem. It is widely known, though infrequently acknowledged, that submarines from several countries often travel through the archipelago under the ice. In 1985, after the Polar Sea incident, the Mulroney government announced that it would acquire 12 nuclear-powered submarines for sovereignty assertion purposes. Pressure from the United States quickly resulted in the abandonment of this plan. Almost two decades later, Canada acquired 4 second-hand diesel-electric submarines from the Royal Navy that are unable to travel completely submerged for more than a few hours, rendering them useless under the ice. Arguably, it works in Canada's favor that submarines transiting the passage do not announce their presence. Some evidence of a sense of legal entitlement is generally considered essential before a country's actions can contribute to creating a right under international law. At the same time, it's quite possible that Canada, as a long-standing U.S. ally, has always known about the submarine voyages and has simply kept quiet. It's even possible that the U.S. Navy, with Canada's knowledge and perhaps covert approval, has installed underwater acoustic sensors at the choke points into the archipelago, though no one will publicly confirm this. And I wouldn't know, so I couldn't confirm it. In November 2004, then Prime Minister Paul Martin declared that sovereignty, quote, is an issue which is becoming even more important given climate change and the opening of the Northwest Passage to transportation and the environmental problems that may flow from that, end quote. Under the Liberal governments of Martin and Jean Chrétien, some initial steps were taken. Auroras are being upgraded with infrared sensors, and unmanned aerial vehicles are being acquired to provide long-range surveillance at lower cost. RADARSAT-2, a federally funded remote sensing satellite built in Richmond, BC, will soon be able to provide up-to-date, high-resolution imaging on demand, giving Canada the ability to track surface vessels from space. Yet more needs to be done. Enforcing sovereignty, a small number of navigable straits and channels in the Canadian Arctic would not require an armada. During the recent federal election campaign, Stephen Harper promised 3 polar icebreakers, a deep water port near Iqaluit, underwater sensors, and a new Arctic-trained airborne battalion. If Harper fulfills his promises, Canada's claim to sovereignty over the Northwest Passage will be more robust. And there is now some reason to believe that he might actually keep this promise. On Thursday, just 3 days after the election, Harper went out of his way to reaffirm that he had, quote, significant plans for defense of our sovereignty, including Arctic sovereignty. Other less dramatic measures could also be taken. Canada currently offers a registration service to all ships entering its northern waters. But this registration service is voluntary, unlike the corresponding services on the east and west coasts. Now, most ships register in order to facilitate search and rescue. But anyone intent on challenging or evading Canadian laws will likely not do so. Making registration mandatory in the Arctic would boost Canada's sovereignty. And it could be done by an order in council. The new Prime Minister doesn't even require legislation to do this. If you're listening,
In addition, the new government could deploy a couple of the Canadian Forces Comrat search and rescue helicopters to Resolute Bay for a few months each summer to ensure compliance with Canadian laws. With a helicopter, you can land on board a foreign vessel. If you're a Canadian Ranger on a snowmobile, you can't. The Department of National Defense is currently deliberating whether to install high-frequency surface wave radar at the entrances to the passage. The time for deliberation is over. The information obtained from these radar stations, I think you need three, maybe four of them, would be useful to the Canadian Forces and Coast Guard, and the presence of the installations, the mere presence, would strengthen Canada's legal position. Most importantly, it's time to persuade Washington to change its outdated position. And I hope that there's at least one person here from the U.S. Consulate General. They usually follow me around, so this is a pretty good guess. The United States is today more concerned about terrorists finding a back door to North America or rogue states using the oceans to transport weapons of mass destruction than it is concerned about Russian submarines. In the Arctic, these new threats could just as easily be handled by a strengthened Canadian Forces and Coast Guard, whose abilities would be much enhanced if Canada's domestic laws applied. It does not serve the interests of either country to have foreign vessels shielded from those laws and subject only to the much weaker constraints of international law. In other words, it doesn't serve the U.S. interest to maintain that the Northwest Passage is an international strait. And the fact of the matter is, Canada would never deny a request from the United States to allow one of its ships or submarines through the passage. This is not an access issue. Indeed, Ottawa and Washington are already planning to expand the North American Aerospace Defense Command to include maritime surveillance later this year. Nor should Washington worry about creating an unwanted precedent for straits elsewhere. And they do worry about this. The sea ice and the resulting paucity of usage of the Northwest Passage has created a situation whereby Canada's Arctic waters can readily be distinguished from the other places where the United States claims rights of transit through international straits. This is not going to create a negative precedent for the Strait of Malacca. This is just too different from those sorts of situations. And indeed, the uniqueness of the situation may help to explain why, in November 2004, then U.S. Ambassador Paul Cellucci admitted that U.S. national security might actually be enhanced if Washington were to recognize Ottawa's claim. "We are looking at everything through the terrorism prism," he said. "Our top priority is to stop the terrorists. So, perhaps when this is brought to the table again, we may have to take another look." End quote. Invitations to negotiate do not come any clearer than that. It is time to show that Canada is willing and able to police its Arctic waters, to make the case, not just with words, that Canadian sovereignty can work for America, too. Thank you.
Professor Byers will, as usual,
here will answer questions, and he will repeat the questions so that those of you back can hear. You'll select it.
And I have a very bad memory, so please keep your questions short. Yes, please. The question is why Mr. Harper, who has a reputation for fiscal restraint, would want to spend a large amount of money on icebreakers if the prime purpose was to protect the environment, which is something he's not overly concerned about, as far as we can tell. Fair enough? I think there are a couple of explanations. One is that there's an economic case for asserting Canadian sovereignty. This is going to be a major international shipping route, whether we like it or not. And no Canadian government is going to want to stop it from being a major international shipping route. In fact, if you're an environmentalist as I am, you would want it to be an international shipping route, because there's a lot of petroleum that isn't burned up by these big ships if they're cutting 7,000 kilometers off of their voyages. The question is, how do you ensure that these transits through the passage occur in the safest way possible? Protecting the environment, protecting security, and all those issues. One way you do that is to charge for putting pilots on board. Charge tolls. Ensure that this is heavily regulated. Not regulated to the point of deterring its use, but to actually make sure that this passage becomes a revenue-generating device for this country. And 7,000 kilometers cut off voyages is extraordinarily attractive to these big international shipping companies. So it makes sense from every perspective that this would be done. There are other explanations. And I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but the U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker fleet is getting old. And either they replace their icebreakers or someone else who's closely allied with them acquires new icebreakers. And it may be that some thought has been given to sharing the burden and for Canada to take on the icebreaking role. I don't know how far those kinds of discussions may have gone. But it is very clear that the United States is thinking about perimeter North American security, that this is a backdoor to North America, that someone is going to have a security presence up there. And the most logical party to do that is Canada rather than the United States. I could be totally cynical and say that Stephen Harper is trying to wave the Canadian flag on this now so that he can sign up to missile defense in a week or two, and all the Canadian nationalists in the room will not be so excited because he's been strong on sovereignty. But I'm not sure that those sorts of calculations have been made. This has happened very fast. I think that there's been longer term thinking about the national interest, or at least the economic interest of Canada and the security needs of both Canada and the United States. Yes, please. The question is about the Northeast Passage, which runs across the top side of Russia. A couple of my colleagues, Louis Fortier from Laval University and David Barber from University of Manitoba, went through the Northeast Passage last summer on a Russian icebreaker and didn't see a single piece of ice. So the Northeast Passage is open. It's already open. And the Russians actually have serious icebreakers and are enforcing their laws in the Northeast Passage. And certainly in the short term, far more traffic is going to go through the Northeast Passage. This is an alternative route, but it's also going to be open. And the question is not, will it be open? The question is, how soon will it be open? And there will be some advantages for some voyages to use the Northwest Passage and other advantages for other voyages to use the Northeast Passage. Not all the traffic is going to go through here. But the amount of shipping that takes place in the world today, and the amount of shipping that goes from Japan, from China, to the east coast of the United States, or from the west coast of North America to the east coast of North America or to Europe, is significant. And on top of that, we have the economic development of the North itself in terms of oil and gas reserves, in terms of there are huge tar sand deposits on Melville Island, for instance. The North is being opened up in very significant ways. Every time I go up and talk to people in places like Iqaluit and Yellowknife, I'm staggered by the fact that in 2004 there was something like 1,200 mineral exploration licenses given in Nunavut. And most of those went to major corporations. Stuff is happening up there. And like I said in my introduction, it's like we're blind to it. It's like most Canadians, myself included, until just a couple of years ago, are totally blind to the fact that we have this massive territory. We have what is going to be a major international waterway. We have a huge amount of economic activity coming in. And yet, we as a public don't seem to care, and as a result, the politicians don't care much either. And very little is happening. Yes, please. Did everyone hear that? It was not a question. But essentially someone who knows the North agreeing with my analysis that the economic activity is going to be huge. Just to give you another example of that, the port of Churchill, which I guess is here, has been bought by a big American company called Omnitrack. And their plan is to develop something called the Arctic Bridge, which is a route that will go straight over the top to Murmansk, Russia, allowing Russian exports to come straight into the heartland of the United States through the port of Churchill. And yes, probably a fair bit of oil. But these are the sorts of things that are happening, and this is why it's staggering that so little has been done. And I don't think personally that Stephen Harper is being all that radical on this. I think he's being fairly reasonable. I quibble over a few things, whether they should be naval icebreakers, as he suggests, rather than Coast Guard icebreakers. I would like to see bright red painted Coast Guard icebreakers with facilities for researchers on board, and if you need it, perhaps a small gun on the front. But these are details. The point is that he seems to want to do something. Although I should say, and I'm not a supporter of 99% of Stephen Harper's policies. I should say that in 1985, a previous government, albeit a progressive conservative government, promised to get serious about the North and then changed its mind. And an earlier conservative government under John Diefenbaker did a similar thing. So periodically there are these expressions of concern and intent, and then they kind of fade away. Right now, with the melting ice, I don't think it's possible that this issue will go away. Right here in the front row. Yes, please. Well, obviously, there's a prime minister designate who's paid some attention to the matter. My encounters with federal government bureaucrats on this, they understand that this is an issue that's coming down the pipeline. It's not one that they've been hugely concerned about, mainly because their political masters haven't been hugely concerned about it. I mean, you have to remember that there are only three federal constituencies in the three territories. Okay? Not a lot of votes and none of it. And so it's not an issue that tends to resonate very deeply. It's an issue, the Arctic and Canadian Arctic sovereignty, that you know, it's a mile wide and it's an inch deep. People, they're concerned about it, but they're not concerned enough to vote on the basis of that concern. And the politicians know that, and the bureaucrats know that. There's also an issue concerning scientific uncertainty. And one of the reasons why I am collaborating with natural scientists who work on the physics of sea ice, or the atmospheric movements and the wind patterns, is to try to provide a little bit more certainty in terms of the timelines involved. I've had government bureaucrats say to me, well, yeah, we probably need an icebreaker, but we might not need it for 30 years. And then I talk to the people who work on sea ice, and they say, no, we need an icebreaker now. And of course, you don't need to have a class 8 icebreaker anymore, because the ice isn't as thick as it used to be. So again, the kinds of equipment you need are changing also. But it's pretty clear that we're not doing very much in the North. The total Canadian military commitment is 230 full-time Canadian Forces personnel based at Yellowknife with four old twin otters, the 1,600 Canadian Rangers part-timers with Lee Enfield rifles and snowmobiles, and occasionally a sovereignty assertion mission. There are, I can't remember exactly, somewhere between 60 and 100 soldiers in Iqaluit right now. In the actual town. I don't know if they've gone outside the town. And we sent a frigate up to Pangerton a couple of years ago. But it's pretty patchy, particularly compared to what countries like Denmark have, or countries like Russia, or even South Africa, which I mentioned, which is actually very serious about the Antarctic, even though it's a lot further from the Antarctic than Canada is from our Arctic. Over here, please. That's an interesting question. Let me just turn this down. We have a maritime boundary dispute with the United States in the Beaufort Sea, right here. This line on the land has been delimited by the 1824 treaty between Great Britain and Russia. Okay, Canada's the successor to the British rights, and the United States bought Alaska from Russia. And that treaty says that, this line here along the line of latitude goes as, quote, far as the frozen ocean. Now, the Canadian position is that as far as the frozen ocean is out here, on the frozen ocean. The American position is, look, it says as far as the frozen ocean. The line ends at the coast, and then the delimitation from there on outwards is done on the basis of equitable equidistance, an equidistance principle that takes the line because of the configuration of the coastline out in an angle like this. And we have a dispute over I try to remember the exact numbers, around 200 square kilometers of seabed, which of course is in potentially quite rich oil and gas areas. I've argued before that it doesn't really matter, because it's likely that if we were to recognize the U.S. claim and they auctioned off the rights to that area, that a Canadian oil company would actually buy the rights, and then the oil and gas would go through a Canadian pipeline over a Canadian territory. Sovereignty and sentiments about sovereignty are sometimes overblown and other times they're not. But because of this dispute, the Americans have not been arguing that they have a sector. They're reevaluating that position now because of something that's happening up here. Because under the 1982 United Nations Law of the Sea Convention, countries having continental shelves can make claims significantly beyond 200 nautical miles from their coastlines if the continental shelf goes out further than that and doesn't drop off to deep ocean. And out here above Ellesmere Island, it's possible that the continental shelf extends all the way 900 kilometers north to the North Pole and beyond. And so we have a potential dispute. Canada has a potential dispute with Denmark, Russia, and the United States over the continental shelf north of Ellesmere. And the Americans are looking at this and going, well, heck, you know, if we had a sector, this could carry all the way up to the North Pole on the basis of the sector. I haven't seen any evidence of a firm commitment to that position yet. And again, I think part of that has to do with the confusion down here. But just in the last 3 or 4 years, the issue of rights in the Arctic has burst onto the scene in a very big way, and the main reason for that is the changing ice conditions, which of course mean that you can think seriously about oil platforms in the Beaufort Sea. And perhaps in you know, 30 or 40 years, you could think about drilling for oil or gas north of Ellesmere, which 20 or 30 years ago would have been technologically very difficult and prohibitively expensive. And of course, it helps now, too, that the price of oil and gas has gone up as high as it has. You want to follow up? Yep. Yes, exactly. And the price of oil and gas is helping that. Two more questions. Okay, I'm going to go to right here, the woman in the yellow shirt and the, I can't tell what color that is. You, yes. Question is, why don't we just want to keep the right to say no rather than just assuming that we would want to allow access for commercial purposes or otherwise? One thing people need to realize is that when I speak of U.S. vessels, I'm speaking of U.S. flag vessels, either naval Coast Guard vessels or vessels, shipping vessels flagged with the American flag, which actually set pretty high standards in terms of environmental protection. The problem is actually flags of convenience. And, single-hulled oil tankers or container ships or other kinds of bulk carriers that have very complicated ownership, lines of ownership through five or six different countries and are flying the flag of a country that doesn't really have a government because it's civil war. And that's where we want to make sure that strict laws apply. And if the truth is known, that's what the Americans would like also. There's a real problem with flags of convenience, with the use of flags of convenience, not just to evade environmental laws worldwide, but also to evade all kinds of other laws, criminal laws, immigration laws. And of course, the problem, which I don't think anyone can deny, of the use of the high seas for trafficking in weapons of mass destruction, missile components, and other such things. Until fairly recently, the high seas have been the Wild West of the world. And it's posed a major problem in very many different kinds of areas, and international law has been slow to catch up. It's still pretty much a Wild West, and I certainly don't think that we want a piece of that Wild West intersecting right through the heart of Canadian territory. Okay, over here. Yeah, the question here is the debate, and certainly my presentation of it is based on the assumption that climate change is going to continue. And the question was whether anyone's concerned about the end game. Yeah. And what happens when the warming continues? I recently co-authored a piece with Louis Fortier and David Barber about this issue, about not just the law and the policy and the sea ice, but also the biological, ecological impact. And we were very careful in the last paragraph to say, look, this is just a tiny part of the puzzle. Okay. This is all important, and we should be concerned about it. But we have to also understand that the reason why we're concerned about this, the reason that this is happening, is because there's a far larger problem, which is climate change. Okay. The Arctic is our canary in the coal mine. Okay, the climate change models will tell us that the early significant impacts of climate change will be most apparent in the polar regions, and particularly in the Arctic, because if there's no sea ice, then the ocean absorbs a lot more heat from the sun than would previously have been the case, and you get feedback loops and all kinds of stuff like that. The reason we're having this discussion is because of the amount of greenhouse gas that the human species has pumped and continues to pump into the atmosphere every year and every day. And even if we were to stop today, the Arctic ice would continue to melt, the sea level would continue to rise. In all likelihood, the polar bear would become in the wild extinct. I mean, there are very dramatic things that are happening. So this is, again, just a very small piece of the puzzle. But in a sense, it's a piece of the puzzle that we can, in Canada specifically, do something significant about. I mean, obviously, there's a very strong imperative to reduce our emissions and to cooperate internationally on that. And I could give another talk about all of the things there. But on the Arctic, little things. An order in council making the registration scheme in the Arctic mandatory. Okay, that could happen on February 7th. Okay, no problem at all. Putting a Cormorant helicopter at Resolute Bay to ensure that we don't lose sovereignty this summer. Little things, but important things. because you can't protect the environment against the very many people in this world who don't give a damn about the environment unless you've got laws that can be enforced. And this is an area where Canada can make a real difference, and that's why I think we should do so. If the Americans think we're doing it because of terrorism, well, that's okay. If Stephen Harper thinks that we're doing it because we need to kiss up to the Americans, well, that's okay, because the important point is that it's going to enable us to protect not just the Arctic environment, but also the Canadian people who live in the Arctic and whose traditional lifestyles still depend upon that environment. This is important. The people in the Arctic who wish us to make use of their historic use and occupancy of the ice want us to protect Canadian sovereignty so that we can protect them and the natural world that they depend upon. And I happen to think that given, among other things, the not so nice ways that we've treated the Inuit, that this is at least one small thing that we could do to redress the balance and to do something significant and positive in the Canadian North. Thank you.
Well, Fernando de la Mora, the president of the International Relations Student Associations, comes to the podium to thank our speaker. I was supposed to have said before this began that in case some of you got a little bit sleepy during the lecture, which I don't think any of you did, but on Monday, on World Wide Web, the tie.ca, there will be a summary of the speaker's talk tonight. Thank you. Fernando.
Thanks very much, John. Well, just like to thank Dr. Byers for giving us certainly a lot to think about, a lot to worry about as well. Strikes me that perhaps we live in Vancouver because we don't particularly like the cold, and we certainly don't like to think about it, but it's always impressive to see how Professor Byers is a step ahead of the game. And the fact that this is the first international issue addressed by the Prime Minister-elect shows that it'll be up there in the bilateral agenda, certainly, between the United States and Canada. And indeed, this is an issue that we wouldn't really be thinking about were it not for global warming. So it's a complex issue, and we should be careful to not get brain freeze as we think about it. And as issues develop, but Dr. Byers has shown us that a PhD is just as good as an MD by removing the blind spot and giving us a lens through which to see this issue. So thank you, Dr. Byers, for breaking the ice while it's still there.